Hey, thanks for stopping by. It's your host, Stephanie Miliano. Remember to follow the Gilded Cast on Instagram, listen and follow on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and don't forget to share it in your group chat. Join me for a conversation with Councilmember Rita Joseph of District 40 of the New York City Council. She's endorsed for your rank one choice in the June 27th primary by the New Majority NYC. Good morning, Councilmember Rita Joseph. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me on the Gilded Cast.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure to be here. I kept on saying, who is this? Paul was like, you gotta talk to her. Just talk to her. I said, all right.
Well, it's me. You are the new council member in District 40. You were part of the wave of women who were elected in 2021. To form the first woman majority council. You're a longtime community organizer who initially set out to be a diplomat, studied international relations in college.
Yes.
You're a Haitian American and raised her family in Flatbush. Again, as a longtime educator, you have a deep sense of the community, how it's been neglected for a very long time. And now you're the chair of the education committee. After a long career as an educator, how does it feel to be part of the women majority city council representing District 40?
It was an honor. Then 21 and 21 was one of the first people to endorse me. And mm-hmm. It caused a ricochet of scandals. Like, how could you guys release your endorsements first? I didn't realize the magnitude of the endorsement until my phone started ringing. And they were like, Joseph, you see what you've done? I said, what did I do? They were like, you're one of the first people they've endorsed in this first round of endorsement. My endorsement came out in October of 2020. So that was like, wow, that this is real. And to be part of this class, it's amazing. I have an amazing set of colleagues that I work with every day in the council to push legislation. You know, when women lead, we lead with empathy and compassion. We lead from a different lens. And 22 years of education, I always tell people in schools is where you see trends. In schools, if you follow the kids, this is where you'll see where your communities are coming from, the different faces that are coming into you. The students that are entering the school buildings, their stories also tell stories of what's happening in the neighborhood.
What's the story that schools are telling now?
That we've always underinvested in schools in terms of social workers, guidance counselors. Even when I was a teacher, I was looking at my guidance counselor at my school. I had 700 kids, but I only had one guidance counselor. Social worker, I had one, 700 kids. That kid will never see. There'll be a majority of kids in that building that will not get to see a social worker. Never. So that's why we're calling, and I invested in last year's budget for mental health continuum, to have mental health support for these students. I had my mom who had COVID. I lost two uncles during COVID. And it was a period of isolation. We kept on going. I attended my uncle's funeral on Zoom, never cried, just went back to teaching because I couldn't let my kids down. I still taught and ran my campaign in the afternoon because I could not let my kids down. I had to show up for them because some of them, their parents were essential workers. I was that other person on the other screen. I was the one setting up the devices with them. A lot of things came to light because of this pandemic. The digital divide that I've been screaming about for years came to fruition. We saw it up front and personal, where the divide was huge. It wasn't just a small group. 25% of the people that live in my district have no access to internet, no type of internet, Wi-Fi, broadband, nothing. Let alone a device. So you can imagine. So when the pandemic hit, I was still running the tech. I was the tech person for the building in my school to move all the educators online, move all the classrooms, and now try to figure out who doesn't have a device where we have to order. It became a point where it was centralized. I would have to order the device because the parent doesn't have a device to order the device. So right. These kids were given paper packets. So you see already there's a divide. There's an inequity in the access to the education, even online. Now, once it arrives, you have to set help the parents set it up. And one of the things I started thinking, I was like, wait, we could do this easier. Started creating videos on how to set up Google Classrooms in different languages. So we had it in Arabic, we had it in Haitian Creole, we had it in Spanish, we had it in Russian, we had it in Urdu. At least we can shoot it out to the parents. They can hear it in their native language and they can start setting up their devices for the kids to get on. And once they got on, now every morning I'm doing wellness calls.
Schools are also telling the story of the larger story of New York City, where a lot of people have moved out of the city, including 200,000 Black New Yorkers, which has also been reflected in changes in school enrollment. And I say changes because it's not only the decrease in enrollment that we saw, but also now the increased enrollment of migrant children. How do those changes, those broader changes in the city, see themselves reflected in your district? And how do they change, how have they changed your priorities and your policies?
When I saw that report, it kind of broke my heart because I was like, that's some of my kids. We haven't had this much of Black families move out of New York City since the Great Migration. So if you go back, you look at the 1950s, they came north. Now you have 200 families going to settle in the South. So what does that say about our city? We're not supportive. We don't have affordability becomes very important. Everything that's going up is market rate. Some of the stuff I can't afford. Some of the stuff are at 120 AMI, and they're asking you to do three times what you're supposed to be making. And food is expensive. The finding a decent place to live is very expensive. So we got to start thinking about affordability. And one of my goals is AMI, but neighborhood AMI. It has to reflect the people that live in the neighborhood. We have people that live in the neighborhood that make $20,000, believe it or not, in this day and age. And then you have people that are making $250,000 up to $800,000 a year. I have CEOs who live in my district. There's parts of my district that when they call, they don't call about, I need help when applying for my one-shot deal. They call me about dog poop. They call me about car idling. So I represent different parts of the district with different reflection of who this district is. It's so diverse that I represent everyone. So it has to meet. It can't be a cookie cutter model. I've never, even as an educator, I don't think teaching kids in a cookie cutter model makes it equitable as well. So everyone, we have to meet everybody where they are. So housing is important. And also we talked about schools. We always talk about how segregated our New York City school systems are. But if housing is segregated, our school system is going to be segregated if it's attached to where you live.
Mm-hmm.
So where you live is where you go to school, but that school is underinvested. So we must invest no matter where kids go to school, they have to be able to get a world-class education. Of course, schools are attached to enrollment. We saw enrollment go down, but we saw new migrant students. So now we have to come in and support with our ENL. I was an ENL coordinator as well. So we have to come in with ESL support, bilingual social workers, bilingual guidance counselors, culturally relevant curriculums.
Changing subjects away from city government and back to your origins in organizing. Just this week, the FDA announced new guidelines, new policies around blood donations that increase access for gay men to donate blood. You're not a total stranger to this issue. So in 1990, you organized a large march/rally against what were referred to as the FDA's quote unquote bad blood policies that restricted blood donations from Haitian Americans. And just this past April was the 33rd anniversary of that march, right?
Yes. Yep.
And that was about like between 100,000 and 150,000 people who marched from Brooklyn across the bridge to downtown Manhattan to protest those policies that were never implemented. Tell me what you remember about that moment. What drove you to help organize this rally? And how do you reflect upon that time? What has stayed with you from that?
I was in high school. I was 19 years old, getting ready to graduate out of high school. And when that came out, we didn't only fight for Haitians and sub-Saharan Africans, but I also fought for hemophiliacs. It was the four H's. It was Haitian, at the time, the gay men, homosexuals, hemophiliacs. And there was one other H that they banned from the list, and also sub-Saharan Africans with no evidence. So at the time, I had a friend of mine named Moses St. Louis. I heard his voice on the radio, on the Haitian radio station, because every Sunday was tradition to listen to Haitian radio station. And I heard him say, I'm calling all young people to come and rally against this. And we were friends since high school, but he was always a couple of years ahead of me. So he was already in college and I was in my last year. And I said, I must get involved. I said, if my parents were ever sick, if I was ever sick, no one could donate that for me. I remember it was grassroots. There was no Facebook, no WhatsApp, no Instagram, no Twitter. So it was going from church to church to mobilize people, going from church, standing on the streets, giving out flyers, going from local radio stations to radio station to echo it out, talking to state, calling New Jersey, calling Philly, calling Boston, calling DC. These were done through phone banking, calling folks to rally. And we thought as young people, we were like, oh, they won't listen to us. We're young and all that stuff. That morning, when I descended down on Tillery, I had the biggest goosebumps ever. And I was like, and at the time, Haitians were always also called Haitian booty scratchers in school. I saw students that I went to school with that I never knew was Haitian, because they hid who they were because they bothered us so much in school. And I was like, wow. When I saw this rally, I stood up in the middle and I said, and I was almost in tears, because I was like, this is the beginning of who I was supposed to be. And that triggered my whole organizing trajectory around immigration, housing. I've been fighting police brutality from Amadou Diallo. I organized the rally from Abner Louima. I organized the rally. That rally, I was part of that committee that put that rally together as a young person. And we fought against a lot of things. 33 years had passed, and I was finally happy to see that FDA finally took gay men off that list, which was so sad that it wasn't evidence-based. That's what the problem was with us. It was like, this was no evidence-based that you were able to do this. So we continue to fight, and it was a small victory for people that to realize that, you know, we're not a community to be played with. We have a voice, and we want to make sure that that voice is heard. And we continue to fight. And through that advocacy, I was able to go to college on a full scholarship with community, because I was such a community advocate. I went to college on a full scholarship. And that's where I thought maybe I wanted to be a diplomat and change the world on that scale. I was able to study abroad in Czech Republic. I studied in Hungary. I studied in Austria right after the fall of communism.
So my last question, how do you practice self-care?
Oh, I get a mani-pedi every 2 weeks. Once a month, I get a facial, which includes a massage. And a lot of quiet time. I read a lot. I try not to read politics a lot. So I stop reading politics. If I can't read, I have Audible. I listen to the books, to some of my favorite books on there. I have Michelle Obama. I went to see Michelle Obama the last time she was in New York. I sat like three rows from her. I was like, and I'm forever first lady, just like I'm a forever educator.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. Talk soon.
Yes, I look forward to it.